you occupy your mind with. That was one of them. After I figured out that people weren't hot in my trail anymore, why, you can do all kinds of things to take your mind off your present predicament. So after about 5 minutes of looking, I found about a 2-inch square piece of the arming area of an AIM-4 Falcon missile. And hell, I thought, well, shit, at least I found some kind of memento for the war. And it helped pass the time a little bit. That afternoon, in the meantime, my G-suit is malfunctioned, as you might imagine. If you got anything at all that's got a zipper on it and you want to save that zipper, you better wash the mud out of it before you try running it up and down. I got mud in my G-suit zipper, and I don't like zippers that hang up, so instead of taking care of them, I try to force them, and first thing you know, it all rips open. So that afternoon, I sat down underneath a little tree on the south bank of a creek, kind of back in the shade there, and I took my knife and I cut the pockets off my G-suit and made them so I could put them up in my gun belt. Well, the Gomers were coming up on the other side of the creek, but I don't know, it seemed to me that I got more confidence that day than any, because they were coming up to work along the north side of the creek, and I was on the south side, and it's about, 100 yards away, and I couldn't see them, they couldn't see me, but they weren't looking for me. It was, just going about their normal business. So right then I said I must have got far enough away from them that they don't know I'm here. And then I made an extra effort of not leaving any more tracks of any kind, never being seen. And that's the one thing I think that if anything stood out the most of why I was a successful survivor was the fact that I was never seen. And I never gave them much of a chance to see me. So if they see you once up there, it's all over. It's just a matter of time, unless you got a helicopter on the way within an hour. So I buried my G-suit, the part that I didn't use. I saved the knife and the pockets. Same way I went for the harness. I saved the life preservers because you got to swim the Red River, right? That's where I saved those. I wished I wouldn't have now because they took up a lot of room. So in these G-suit pockets I had here, I had my water flask and I had a LPU in it, plus any fruit that I scarfed up off the ground. Every day the damn gun belt got heavier and heavier, I guess because my ass was shrinking. I was losing fat and it kept sliding down further. It seemed like it weighed a ton after about 20 days. The next day it was raining a little bit, and I was always under the impression there's a Gomer behind every damn tree, I guess it was a good thing I thought that. I heard this thrashing around in the bushes down below, and I thought, Jesus Christ, they're almost on top of me. So I jumped down behind this one tree trunk, and some bitch kept coming. Goddamn, they must have seen me. I was really fearing for the worst, and I crouched down a little lower, and finally the brush about 5 feet away was moving from the bottom. What the hell? And just about then I saw a lizard look out of underneath the brush pile, and the biggest son of a bitch I've ever seen. And he finally come out in the open, and then when he put his head up and looked, it was about this high off the ground. I estimate he weighed around 40 pounds, but I think he's probably closer to 60. So I never thought about, I wasn't that hungry that I'd want to shoot a lizard right then, And beefsteak sure tasted better than lizard. I knew it would because it had to have been raw. So all the sticks were wet anyhow, but I took one. I thought, well, see how spooky this bastard is. So I poked him upside the head, and he hissed a little bit and didn't even move. So I found a bigger piece of old bamboo and I stuck him in the eye with it, and then he started growling. So I just sat back there with my hand on my gun in case he's going to jump me, and finally he just kept on moving up the hill, and as soon as he left, I hauled ass. But I was really surprised. I never saw a creature. I read about them in National Geographic, but I never seen one that goddamn big. And I found some of their dens. They make a den about the size of a coyote hole. They're pretty good size. I figured all they'd eat was frogs and insects, but I'm not so damn sure. I think he'd had, what I was really afraid of him was he might take a nip at my leg, and I think he, reptiles got strong jaws, he probably could have broken my ankle, and I didn't want that to happen. So outside of that encounter, the next thing I encountered was a banana tree with bananas on it, and I thought, shit hot. So I jumped on with my knife, and I cut it down in about three chops. It turned out to be monkey bananas, and you know, the only way you're going to get anything out of them is to cook them. And that damn little survival manual notebook he got says, everything's good in the jungle, guys, as long as it's cooked, fried, or roasted, and I didn't have any matches. And I wasn't about to take the chance on building a fire anyhow. So here's some things you might want to think about. I didn't want to shoot my gun either because it make a lot of noise. Maybe some of you got a 22 with a silencer on it, or maybe a slingshot, or maybe a Benjamin pump pistol. You know, vary the amounts of air that you pump in it. If you can carry one of those in addition to your 38 or personal weapon, it might help you get some game. But maybe it's a good thing I didn't eat any meat, because I'd probably got trichinosis, tapeworm, or some liver disease out of eating raw mammals. Don't eat any raw fish up there either. You get, well, best you can get shits for life. And who knows what you're going to catch. So unless you can cook it, unless you got a fire, I'd stay away from the animal life up there, especially snails, anything that comes out of the water, because their water is very contaminated. So getting back to up in the weeds there, after I cut out the my G-suit apart and buried it, I first come across the first sign of, well, you might want to say human habitation. They cut a lot of trees down up there, and the tall type, they either make railroad ties or telephone poles out, and they slide them down the ditch until it gets down the flats there, and then they load them up on the trucks. So I was very careful to stay away from the side of them, walking away from their trails and what have you. Again, that night I got rained on. Didn't sleep too good because it rained damn near all night. So I got up first light in the morning and made it down about another 400 yards, and in the middle of a small banana grove, and I passed out, you might want to say. I was really tired. And I was lucky enough to pass out, my feet hanging out into an area where the sun shone most of the day, so when I woke up 3 in the afternoon, my feet were almost dried out. So I finished drying myself out, and the people were working around me, maybe a quarter mile all the way around, but cutting down trees. I knew they wouldn't bother me, mainly because of the monkey banana grove, and who in the hell wants to come looking for monkey bananas? That night it rained again, really soaked me up. It rained so hard that the creek down about 200 yards from me overflowed its banks. So I knew the bastards weren't going to come up early the next morning because it's still raining, and the clouds come down almost to on top of me. I went down about another 100 yards that day into this little area overlooking an abandoned garden, and that first come across their big trail that went back up to the mountains. So I was overlooking their trail for all day. I come across the area I was setting down in. There's a tree right beside me that had the second type of fruit that I had. It's about an inch in diameter, a little bit dark in the color of your chairs there. It had kind of a woody skin to it that was unedible. But on the inside, it had three little sections about the size of a pomegranate, but didn't have any seeds in it. It's kind of sweet, tasted pretty good, and that's the one I didn't bust my ass because this tree wasn't very big, and I climbed all the way up to the edge of it and reached all as far as I could get all the fruit off, and I filled up my two pockets with it. So I was, again, feeling pretty good that you could scrounge in the jungle like that. About 4 in the afternoon, it quit raining, and I heard the guy coming up the trail. So I squatted down and looked out through my little peephole, and I saw the first North Vietnamese I ever seen, except the one in the club up at Udorn. There's an old Papa San about 4 years old, and his little kid about 4 years old were going up, I guess, to pick up something up in the woods and bring it back down. The trail went through a little ditch, pretty steep ditch, and Papa-san picked up his little boy and took him down, set him down on the other side, and the kid went skipping behind his dad, whistling and having a good time. So I thought maybe they're not such bad sons of bitches after all, but still I didn't trust them. And then they come home about a half hour later. And they're just regular old hill people. You know, the clothes they wore is what they could scrounge up from somewhere. And right then I decided, well, maybe there isn't so many troops around after all. They probably got them all moved south. So that night, I got pissed off of getting rained on all the time, so I scrounged a whole shitload of banana leaves, and I made a nice place to lay down on, plus a roof over my head, and it didn't rain that night. Kind of right then I said, I am not going to worry about getting rained on anymore. One thing I might add, every morning when I got up to leave the area that I slept in, I redistributed all the trash that I used for a bed, make it look like nobody was there. It's a good thing I did. It never gave them anything to go on. So here comes the mistake, the biggest mistake I made during the whole outfit. Got up at first light. I knew the guys wouldn't be out for about an hour and a half. So I got down on that trail because that trail didn't have any bushes on it. And I started hauling ass down it. I didn't walk on the trail itself. I walked off to the side on the grass. And hell, I made it a mile in about, you know, 15 minutes. I was really, really doing good. Well, up to that time, I was 8 miles behind my schedule. And it's one thing you don't get yourself into is going down a trail. The trail went to a village, so I cut across the outskirts of the village, went up a few little small ridge lines and went through some gardens. At that time, the gardens were very immature, and as were the fruit trees. They had just blossomed and the fruit had just set on. So right now, you ought to have good pickings up there, but I hope you don't have to go up there to pick cherries. I did reach across one and pick up some chives. I hate the damn things, but there was something to eat. Being very careful not to step on the ground, but just reached in as far as I could from the outskirts. Across this one little creek that I went, it was a collection spot for this one village to get their water. They had bamboo pipes running all the way down, so I thought, well, shit, you know, I'm not down yet. So I took one of their pipes apart like an animal would knock it down and cut off their water just for the hell of it. Made me, you know, that's something psychologically you say, what do you do? And that was one of them. You know, give them a little grief now and then. So I went about three more ridge lines. It's pretty small hills. And finally I come out in this great big son of a bitch and wide path, about as wide as a group of these chairs. And I was just bebopping down the road and having a good time. And the sun was starting to get pretty high. And all at once I heard guys in front of me and guys behind me. So I run up about another 100 yards up the top of the hill to see where in the hell the road went to. And just about the same type of land. And there's two gomers coming down the road from the west about a quarter mile. And the guys behind me were getting closer and closer to us talking. So I jumped off the north side of the road and went north about 100 yards. And when you have to do things like that, you get in a hell of a bind. Well, the water buffalo had grazed through the area and they tramped down most of the underbrush. They'd eaten part of it. And it wasn't too good an area to hide, so I laid down flat on my back. I scraped up all the shit I could and started laying on my feet all the way forward. And about 5 minutes later, two little kids walked by on the road. And I'll be damned if they didn't turn in what seemed like about another 100 yards and walk over here, and there's a goddamn village over here. So I ended up between the main road and a pretty good-sized village, and I wouldn't call it an orchard. It was kind of like a windbreak, you know. They had trees planted in rows. And I was right exactly between the main road and the village of, as it turned out, about 200 people. So it was after breakfast now, and the kids were out playing. It must have had about 30, 40 kids, youngsters. They would play up and down the rows of trees, and I was really in a fix. I thought about getting up and and sneaking out the back way I come in. Maybe it was a good thing I didn't, because somebody might have seen me. There was a kid that sat down behind me about 40 feet away, the area that I wanted to get out of. So I knew I couldn't get up and go for a while. And he cut down. I saw him out of the back of my eye. He's hacking on something. And I saw a bamboo tree fall over about 3 inches in diameter. And he sat back here hacking cups and shit out of it for about 2 hours. And then I got to looking around at where there's some more of those bamboo out in that place. And there's two of them right between my legs. So I thought, shit, man, if he has to cut more than his share of cups today, I'm going to be in deep shit. But fortunately, he quit cutting cups about 2 hours later. And the damn little kids were still out playing around. They're pretty militant when they're a young age. I saw 10 of them go by on the next row down. They had a little piece of bamboo like rifles, and they was marching along to some, they were singing a song. And they train their kids early to be carrying arms. There's one thing I noticed. There's a lack of men or boys between the age of 10 and 40. I think they got them, well, they shipped them all out to fight is what happened. I think when a kid reaches about 10 to 12 years old, he gets shipped out, and then if he gets crippled or what have you, they send him back home unless he's 40 or 50 years old. So that went all day long. The kids playing up and down. Once in a while, I hear some kid getting paddled by the old man. And just like a normal village, kids raising hell, and then they get the shit kicked out of them by the folks, and then they go back to doing something else. Well, supper time come along, and I still didn't want to take the chance to get up and go to right behind me. About 12 o'clock, I noticed a bunch of water. I could hear a bunch of water buffalo bedding down, well, behind me a ways. And so I knew that if they weren't spooked, they knew I wasn't there. And two little kids come out to get the water buffalo about 7 o'clock. And they're beating and hollering behind me. I hear the water buffalo getting up, and they're having a hard time getting them in. Finally, I thought they got all of them in. They come back about 5 minutes later, and they're starting to holler and raise hell about 30 to 40 feet behind me. And I thought, shit, maybe they seen me, but I still wasn't going to move. All during the day, I was gathering more stuff to put over me as far as I could reach around. I thought I had myself covered halfway decent. And finally, things got quiet. Nobody said anything, and I felt something come across my ankle. I thought, shit, there's a kid standing on my ankles, but I still wasn't going to move. Because I thought he's young enough, he may not be able to tell it's a human. If I surely, you know, looked at him, why, he'd be a human. He'd go run and tell Papa-san, but I figured if he couldn't figure out who I was and he tried to tell Papa-san there's some kind of a blob out there, he wouldn't believe him. So I stood there and stood there, and all at once the kid started hollering. Oh, shit. So one of the two kids ran back to the house, and I thought, I really had it now. This other one's standing on me, and the other one's going to get the gun. And pretty soon here comes a bigger boy with a stick, and he's beating on the brush on the way back and hollering. And I thought for sure my number was up. And he got right behind me, started hitting me, and not me, but the something behind me is a water buffalo. And what happened, the water buffalo stepped on a branch that went across my leg, and he wouldn't go past me because he smelled me. And they hit him. I saw a water buffalo ass go by, and then the three kids walked right behind him and never even saw me about 3 feet away. So I breathed a sigh of relief there, and as soon as they went home, I hauled ass behind about 100 yards from where I was and slept for the rest of the night. I did notice a little bit of a mountain behind the village before I got caught in their yard. So I made it up that hill the next morning, and that's where I was for the last 13 days. But coming up the village, I went up a creek for a little bit, and there again they had this nice water pipe system. I dismantled another section of it and drank some water, and then I made it up the hill. one-third of the way up the hill, they had their garden. They had a big, stout bamboo fence around it. I guess they got some wild hogs or something running around up there. They still had a very immature garden. The next one-third of the way up the mountain was was burnt over once upon a time, about 10 years ago, I expect. They had grass about 3 feet high. They had a lot of bamboo that had fallen down, and some second-growth trees about 50 feet high. So I made it up into that area, and I went over to the southwest slope, and there's an area with no trees, about 100 feet in diameter. And I figured it'd be a good place to get picked up by Jolly Green, which was the place where I was picked up. I tramped down a bit of grass there to lay down in and away from the trees, and then I also had an area about 50 feet to the back where I had two different kinds of beds, one with the leaf base and the other with bamboo. I didn't worry any at all about covering my tracks up there because that was the last mountain I was on, and everything else was flat between there and the next ridge line, which is the ridge line east of Yen Bai. So I kind of run out of ideas right about then. Nothing but the flats out in front of me and hardly no place to go except backtrack. Well, it was up there where I learned out their habit patterns down in the village. They had, I don't know if it was an old howitzer shell or a gong that they used for their bell, but about an hour after first light in the morning, they'd ring the bell. Everybody'd get up, and I think somebody had the breakfast going long before they rang the bell. Take them about an hour and a half to go out into the fields. They ate their breakfast, did their chores, and what have you. They did all their heavy work between then and 9 in the morning, like cutting down trees or plowing with the water buffalo, all the big chores. At 9 o'clock, the gong would ring again, and the people would knock off for about 30 minutes. I could see the ones down in the rice paddies would go sit down in the shade, and I guess they had a drink or maybe some rice ball to eat or something. From about 9:30 to 12, they kind of knocked off the heavy work and retired back into the shade area, and you could hear them constructing things out of bamboo or building things, and they'd do some light work out in the rice paddy, like a weed around the edge of it and things like this. 12 o'clock, the gong would ring, and they'd knock off for 2 hours to go eat and have a siesta in the noon or whatever. Seems like most people around here, especially kind of like Mexico, they knock off for a long time for dinner. From about 2 o'clock, 2 o'clock to about 4 o'clock, they'd finish up and all the light chores. And from about 4 to 6, they'd go out in the field and redo their heavy work, like cut down some more trees and do some more plowing. Around 6:30, there'd be somebody start yelling down in the village, you know, like everybody come home at supper time or something like that. And all the people would start gathering home, and then they'd ring the bell about 7 o'clock. They'd have their supper, and after supper, that was the best time of the day for them. You could hear them singing songs. You could hear them sound like the kids were playing games and having a good old time. And about a half an hour after last light, it had to be the village chief do the ring of the gong, the go-to-sleep bell, because he'd ring it 3 times, bong, 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 and then it sounded like he took the dinger and just it hit the side of the bell, and it just, you know, keep getting slower and slower, faster and faster until it quit. And then he was the one that do it 19 times, 19 dings on it. And then one day he must have been sick. Somebody else did it. They really cobbled it up. But this one village, the old village chief, he'd make 19 dings out of the go-to-sleep bell. So I had them all figured out of when I could move, but right about 5:30, when it was coming in out of the mountains or out of the fields, well, the sun went behind the trees behind me, and I went down to get my water about 200 feet away. I was careful not to have any sunlight shine off my face. Of course, when I moved, I took it off my mosquito net. But when I was sitting still, I had my mosquito net on. One of the things that I did, I used to do a lot of coyote hunting when I was a kid, and I guess I learned a little bit out of those old wily coyotes that never get seen, but they always know what everybody else is doing. So I was parting the grass out, looking at the people, never let any sunlight shine directly on my face. Be real careful not to make any fast movements in case somebody 5 miles away on a lookout tower or something could see you. Getting back to some other things that I could have had on me that I didn't. The E&E maps you carry with you, the one I carried forever and ever, was in this pocket. It was the one with Ban Ban in the center of it. And it quit right north of Sam Nui, and it was old and wrinkled and had cracks in it along the ridge line there. So the optimum you can have is the current area for once, and two semi-new, or if they're not new, maps, because one of them I got to curl up like an armadillo to keep from getting wet on just one of them, and then it had a crack or had holes down the center line of it. If you had two of those, you'd pretty much keep dry from the rain. The only thing that saved me is I knew where I was, and I knew much of the terrain and latitude and longitude, whatever you want to call it. Also up there, not too much exciting happened. You know, people say, well, hell, for 13 days you must have seen all kinds of shit. But things settle down after you figure out, know what to expect out of them, and they never come up to bother me. So I had no many ideas run through my head on what to do. So some of the things I saw up there, pass along to you guys. Up until about the 26th, 27th of May, the guys did a lot of practice, and seemed like it was a MiG-21s from Fukien versus a MiG-19 Farmers from Yanbai. 8 o'clock and 12 o'clock was those two gaggles. After the second day, I could see the 21s come in, or after they'd already come across Yanbai. They'd send two of them out of Fukien, they'd sonic boom Yanbai, and they'd head up to the northwest, and they'd scramble three MiG-19s out of the revetments after them. It'd take them about 3 minutes to get airborne. I couldn't see the 19s until it was about 1,000 foot in elevation, climbing over the top of that one ridge line. And they'd go up northwest of Yanbai and break the sonic near the sound barrier for about 10 to 15 minutes. And that sonic booming would quit, and pretty soon you'd see two contrails coming from the northwest heading the southeast, which were the 21s, RTB, and they'd run under GCI control, and they'd run a 90-degree intercept with no reattack, come back around and run another 90 with a reattack. And the way those contrails merged on the reattacks, those guys got their shit together. And then they'd descend down into Fukien, and they'd quit contrailing. About shortly thereafter, out of the clear blue sky or clouds or what have you, three 19s would come thrashing down, dogfighting amongst themselves between the mountain I was on and the next ridge line right east of Yanbai. And they just fell as soon as they got down on the deck, and they'd head out northwest of town, and pretty soon they'd come back. Now here's I guess you'd call it their patrol formation. I couldn't tell the lateral separation on two behind one, but as far as in trail goes, he was about 1,000 to 2,000 foot in trail of lead. And they'd predominantly run the ridge line and the mountain peaks, staying below them about 100 to 500 feet. And they'd patrol up and down the area. Now here's a kicker. Blue 3 would be about 2.5 to 3 miles in trail. He'd be in the center of the valley on the deck. So be aware, anytime you jump two 19s up there, they're going to have a trailer. Be awful easy to do. See two of them together, and we always think in terms of twos and fours when they're actually flying a flight of three. And they'd make about four laps around that one hill, and then they'd go out northwest of town again. And then they'd come back. This time they're doing their trail work. One, two, and three, about 500 to 1,000 foot behind each other, and they'd practice hard level turns. Until you ever seen a MiG-19 do a hard level turn, you haven't seen anything at all. The leader would roll up his wings. Next thing I saw is a plan view of him. Next thing he's heading back 180 degrees the way he come in. He's running right around 400 knots, not any faster. Maybe some of you know Major Hanley of Eglin that's up at Udorn, TDY. He got a MiG-19 with an E model with a gun. He was pulling 9 Gs in the son of a bitch, and he was losing out on him when he hit him. So those guys can pull a tremendous amount of Gs, and they got a turn radius that'll water your eyes. As far as we know now, they also got the Chinese Communist mod to the hydraulics on the rudder and the stabilator, that they've had no trouble at all going 600 calibrated with us nowadays. So the Dutch roll is out on the 19s. It's almost the same as an F-4 now, up to about 10,000 feet. And in the afternoon, well, I might add, I heard a flight of 19s take off one afternoon, and they went up northwest of town. I could hear them shooting their cannons, so they must have some kind of a gunnery range up there. In the afternoon at 4 o'clock, the 21s would fly over about, now there's sonic booming, and they'd practice high altitude or medium to high altitude intercepts, GCI type, up northwest of Yen Bai. I finally got to the point where I could recognize the difference in sound between a 19 and a 21. For you Thud drivers, when a 21 pulls her back to idle at altitude, it sounds like one of yours. A lot of resonation, a lot of noise, vibration. It's very characteristic. The 19 is a pretty quiet airplane, probably much like the T-38. The 19s do a, if they're not on a scramble, they'll do a two-engine run-up just like the F-4. But I never could actually hear their afterburner light. But as far as a MiG-21, it's got a, takes a while for its afterburner to light, and it's about half as loud as your Thud. It is a hard light. That's just about all the activity that I saw them do, but the one that really got my attention was the 219s plus the one in trail, 2.5 to 3 miles. One other thing that I saw the MiGs do, one morning I was sitting out there and I heard some jets coming in from the west. I saw three camouflage planes pop up over the hill coming towards me. And I thought, well, shit, here comes somebody sneaking into Hanoi, you know, going to bomb the shit out of them. I took out my radio and I come up on beeper for about 2 seconds and I saw they had pitot booms. Well, they could have been F-4Es, but pretty good sized pitot boom, and so I put my antenna back and watched them. About 30 seconds later, they went down past me, and they pulled up, and it's silver bottom MiG-21s. It's camouflaged on top, and the camouflage they had was a little darker than ours. It's more glossier paint. The greens are more greener, or more shiny green than ours. I don't know if any of you run across any camouflage 21s yet. I heard the Navy had, and I saw those three. Plus, they've been running into a lot of camouflaged MiG-17s. As far as I know, nobody's seen any 19s in camouflage. Any of you fellas? I don't know if they do that yet. Well, that's about the sum total of the MiGs. Pretty sneaky little bastards. About the 1st of June come along, I was just about ready to go down into the flats to scrounge some protein. They had ducks and geese down there along with some chickens. And I was under the impression that I was getting low on protein because my muscles are not as strong as it was, and I was really tired. It's getting to be a pain in the ass, or really tired to go down and get my water down at the creek 200 yards away. Well, as it turned out, the protein analysis on me when I got back, I was still within limits, but still, I still had to get something to eat. Right above me, gray squirrels were playing, just like we got back in the States, about 10 feet away, but I still didn't want to shoot my gun. That's why I think if you had an air pistol or something, you'd have more of a chance of getting some small animals. They had birds up there about the size of robins. And there's plenty to eat as far as meat goes if you'd had some way, some gun that didn't make too much noise. Well, the 1st of June come along, and I was going to get up at first light and go down to the flats. I knew I was probably going to get caught. I thought I had to take the chance. A couple days before that, I'd taken out my pointy talkie and I'd learned the Vietnamese phrase for please, thank you, do you have any food and shit like that. I doubt if it had done any good, but I still took it out and studied it. Another thing I learned was they pulled on me in, at the POW camp at Fairchild was, what's the number of your ID card? So I memorized that. And also your Geneva Convention card, I memorized the date of the act. And one thing I thought they could really get me on if I was taking prisoners, I didn't know the damn amendments to the Constitution. I don't know if any of you guys do that. That's one of their, the things that they play up. So I hate to be a tell you things like that, but think about that. If you ever get caught, they're going to make a big to-do if you don't know much about your own government. Also, I had a what I thought was a good mustache. The third day I was up there, I shaved it off because I didn't want them to yank it out one by one at a time. One of the reasons I E&E'd for so long was it was the first combat tree aircraft to get shot down over the north, and I didn't want to compromise our tactics. So that was one of the reasons I tried the E&E for as long as I did. Well, as it turned out, Joe Kittinger got shot down the next day in a tree aircraft. I didn't know that. And as it turned out, the guys in the tactics at UDOR never even thought of shit like that, so I guess it wouldn't make any difference. Okay, getting back to the 1st of June again, I overslept. I didn't get up at first light, and it was about 8 o'clock, and the people are already out in the field, and I says, oh, shit, I got to stay up here another day. And I went back to sleep, and about 8:30 I woke up and said, wait a minute. Now, you guys will probably laugh at this, but it isn't any laughing matter at all. I didn't hear any large amount of AAA being fired for the last 5 days. So I figured, I guess what happened, you guys never hit any targets on the Northwest Railroad. You hit on the Northeast Railroad the last of May. And I thought they suspended the bombing or something. And I thought, now wait a minute, damn Air Force, if it's going to make a heavy, it's going to be 9 o'clock on the 1st of the month. And, you know, a lot of you guys are laughing, but goddamn it, how many times has it happened? So I thought, well, shit, there's going to be planes up in the Hanoi area probably at 9 o'clock because, and I knew it was going to be Air Force because the Navy's TOT is 1400 in the afternoon. And I thought, yeah, you're full of shit. So I laid back down, went to sleep, and right at 9 o'clock, you'd hear boom, 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 boom down to the south. What happened, U-Bahn was hitting Viet Tri at that time, and you'd hear the AAA being shot bang, shit hot. So I got all my stuff together and I went out in the open area and just waited. And right before my eyes, a lever flight from UDORN found three new SAM sites at the end by. And surprised the shit out of me. You'd actually hear the SAMs coming off, a big old hiss when they get launched, and you hear the sustainer fire, or the booster falling off, and the sustainer lighting, and the damn air burst. Now it's big as a Mark 82. Makes a hell of a big bang. So I waited till Lover got done doing their ACM with the SAMs and gave everybody about 5 minutes until all the noise stopped to get out of the area and get their shit together. And I come up on the radio with any Air Force aircraft that reads Oyster Run Bravo come up guard. And just like that, Sonic was up and Fletch was up. And from talk a little bit about radio tactics that you use. I was still leery of getting ADF by the Gomers, and I still didn't think there was going to be a SAR effort for me, and all I wanted to get across was I was still alive to relay to my home base. So from here on, if you stop and look back at the way maybe some of you run across Gomers on the radio, they're going to use perfect English if they can and perfect radio transmissions. So I was never very good for RT for myself, so I had it knocked right there. Plus, if any of you got a drawl, use it, or just talk like a normal GI, throw in a few cuss words. I says, hey man, I've been down here for 22 days, any chance of getting me out? And I wanted them to understand that I wasn't anybody from that day that got shot down, but still, I didn't want the Gomers to linger on the 22 days or they'd figure out who in the hell it was they shot down and they'd start looking in that area again. And they says, okay, we'll relay. And I thought, oh, shit. And tell King, too, while you're at it, you know, just in case they want to get something going. So they said they'd relay. Hell, and then they said something I thought they'd never say. Says, well, the Sandys and Jollies are on their way. Oh, shit, you know, maybe I am kind of lucky, but I still didn't expect them to get that far. And starting about right here is where I think the rest of my flight kind of let us down by not knowing our exact position. Because Sandy spent about 30 minutes southwest of Yen Bai, that one flat spot out there, looking for me. It finally dawned on both of us about the same time. He said, are you, which side of the river you're on? I said, the northeast. He said, oh. So in the meantime, the MiG-21 made two passes on a Jolly Green that was unnecessary. And Sandy got the hell hosed out of him. So because of that, you can sure help out those guys from not so much exposure by knowing exactly where they are. What I suggest, if you don't already do it, a lot of guys, especially the Gibbs, just look in their damn INS and they figure out where they are from the latitude and longitude by putting it out on a damned old J-11 chart or something smaller. The only way you're going to do it is look down at the frickin' ground and get some known spot, some characteristic spot, and if you don't carry one, come back in here and go on to the 1 to 50,000 chart, one of them UTM doofers, because that's going to save a lot of hard times for the rescue forces. I couldn't believe it. The position they had for me was 30 miles off from where I went down. So I can't overemphasize nowhere in the hell the guy went down. So Sandy's out there thrashing around. Finally he says, okay, I'm going to try to cross the river. And he tried to cross it right north of the Omega, I guess. And he did get across the Red, and then there's that next river up here. I forget the name of it. I was still east of that second little river. And all at once, hell, the whole sky opened up down there by that dam, 85s and 57s. And Sandy mentioned he's getting his ass shot off. He says, you getting shot at by 85s? He says, yeah, okay. Until I think I know where you're at, and I'm about 015 degrees for 5 miles from there. And finally, he said what I was hoping he'd said all the way along. He says, well, let's go out and regroup. I said, okay, I'll see you tomorrow. Because I knew if they'd tried to make a start effort that first day, it'd probably be disastrous because they used all their resources on their primary target up in Hanoi that day. So the best thing they could have done was go home and plan it out that night, which is what they did. Thanks a lot to Colonel Vovodich. Next morning come along, well, that afternoon they sent a Laredo up, fast fact, to look for him, and he stayed west of the SAM ring, and I could hear him five square, but he never could get two-way communications with me. Next morning come along, I was the first guy up that day. I've even beat the rooster up. I was sitting out there in my little spot waiting, and nothing happened, and I was under the impression that I'm not going to come up on radio until I hear somebody, jet noise. Well, 6 o'clock come along, I thought, well, shit, I had four spare batteries. I said, I got all these spare batteries, and I only used about 15 minutes worth of radio so far. So every 5 minutes, I'm going to monitor guard for 1 minute. So the first time I pull it up, here's old squadron mate Joe Burley asking me to come up, beeper voice, and I says, hey man, how you doing? All the time, you know, keeping loose language, because I still thought they might think I was a Gomer. To back up the first day, the second thing Sandy asked me, what was my mother's name, which is one of my authenticator questions, and I answered him. I remember I had all the rest of the three ready to go for the second day, and he surprised me. But anyway, Joe and I started talking. He was a weather recce, and he was supposed to get voice contact with him, which is what he did. And then he asked me a question that was, well, It turned out to be a stupid question, and any of you that go up on a SAR, don't ask one of these to a guy on the ground. He asked me, where am I from the tall, towering cumulus cloud that goes up to 15,000 feet? And from the ground, you don't know fuck all what the altitude of that cloud is. So I said, I'm going to have to look around the weeds here. Wait a minute. So I looked up, and there's this great big cumulus cloud about right west of me. He said, I'm 090 from about 15. He says, okay, got to be going. See you later. And he said he thought of it on the way home, and I thought of it after he left. Now, wait a minute. I got to look, and there's another big old cumulus cloud to the southwest. So don't ask any question like that. Use something useful if there's a fire on the ground or some particular mountain peak, because mountain peaks stick out good. But then you can't tell the relative position of the mountain peak to give to him on the ground, but he definitely can't tell the tops of the clouds from the ground. So I waited and waited, and nothing happened. Shit, for about 2 hours. Christ, man, maybe it is no SAR effort. They just come up to talk to me. And about 9:30, I was sitting up there, and all once I hear these noise of the jets in the background. They keep getting louder and louder, and finally, I heard the gun start opening up at Yen Bai, and I thought, well, shit, here they come. And I looked up. Well, it was about 5/8, 6/8 broken clouds were in. It was Colonel Miller of U-Bahn, as it turned out to be. I saw his four ship come out through the clouds, get spacing, and roll in on the north end of the runway. And about 10 seconds later, another four ship rolled in on the south end. The MIG-CAP went overhead, and another four ship was holding high. So all at once, there's 16 aircraft on top of me, and I felt pretty good. But then, if any of you ever been on the ground on a SAR effort, it hits you all at once, just thinking, shit, I hope nobody gets shot down because of me. And, you know, it's a weight that comes over your body, or over your heart, I might add, that you just hope everybody makes it home safely. Well, the gooks are shooting the hell out of them with 85 and 57.